new, empty German eyes, and other countries immediately confound him with his dressing gown. I mean to say that let German depth be what it will. Among ourselves alone, we perhaps take the liberty to laugh at it. We shall do well to continue henceforth to honor its appearance and good name, and not barter away too cheaply our old reputation as a people of depth for Prussian smartness and Berlin wit and sand. It is wise for a people to pose and let itself be regarded as profound, clumsy, good-natured, honest, and foolish. It might even be profound to do so. Finally, we should do honor to our name. We are not called the Tiuschevolk, deceptive people, for nothing. The good old time is past. It sang itself out in Mozart. How happy are we that his Rococo still speaks to us, that his good company, his tender enthusiasm, his childish delight in the Chinese and its flourishes, his courtesy of heart, his longing for the elegant, the amorous, the tripping, the tearful, and his belief in the South can still appeal to something left in us. Ah, sometime or other it will be over with it, but who can doubt that it will be over still sooner with the intelligence and taste for Beethoven, for he was only the last echo of a break and transition in style, and not, like Mozart, the last echo of a great European taste which had existed for centuries. Beethoven is the intermediate event between an old and mellow soul that is constantly breaking down, and a future over young soul that is always coming. There is spread over his music the twilight of eternal loss and eternal, extravagant hope. The same light in which Europe was bathed when it dreamed with Rousseau, when it danced round the tree of liberty of the revolution, and finally almost fell down in adoration before Napoleon. But how rapidly does this very sentiment now pale? How difficult nowadays is even the apprehension of this sentiment? How strangely does the language of Rousseau, Schiller, Shelley, and Byron sound to our ear, in whom collectively the same fate of Europe was able to speak, which knew how to sing in Beethoven. Whatever German music came afterwards belongs to Romanticism, that is to say, to a movement which, historically considered, was still shorter, more fleeting, and more superficial than that great interlude, the transition of Europe from Rousseau to Napoleon, and to the rise of democracy, Weber. But what do we care nowadays for Freischutz and Oberon, or Marschner's Hans Heiling and Vampir, or even Wagner's Tannhauser? That is extinct, though not yet forgotten, music. This whole music of Romanticism, besides, was not noble enough, was not musical enough to maintain its position anywhere but in the theater and before the masses. From the beginning, it was second-rate music, which was little thought of by genuine musicians. It was different with Felix Mendelssohn, that halcyon master, who, on account of his lighter, purer, happier soul, quickly acquired admiration and was equally quickly forgotten as the beautiful episode of German music. But with regard to Robert Schumann, who took things seriously and has been taken seriously from the first, he was the last that founded a school, do we not now regard it as a satisfaction, a relief, a deliverance that this very romanticism of Schumann's has been surmounted? Schumann, fleeing into the Saxon Switzerland, mountains north of Dresden, of his soul, with a half-Werther-like, half-Jean-Paul-like nature, assuredly not like Beethoven, assuredly not like Byron, his Manfred music is a mistake and a misunderstanding to the extent of injustice. Schumann, with his taste, which was fundamentally a petty taste, that is to say, a dangerous propensity, doubly dangerous among Germans for quiet lyricism and intoxication of the feelings, going constantly apart, timidly withdrawing and retiring, a noble weakling who reveled in nothing but anonymous joy and sorrow, from the beginning a sort of girl and touch me not. This Schumann was already merely a German event in music. music and no longer a European event, as Beethoven had been, as in a still greater degree, Mozart had been. With Schumann, German music was threatened with its greater danger, that of losing the voice for the soul of Europe and sinking into a merely national affair. What a torture are books written in German to a reader who has a third ear. How indignantly he stands beside the slowly turning swamp of sounds without tune and rhythms, without dance, which Germans call a book. And even the German who reads books, how lazily, how reluctantly, how badly he reads. How many Germans know and consider it obligatory to know that there is art in every good sentence, art which must be divined if the sentence is to be understood. If there is a misunderstanding about its tempo, for instance, the sentence itself is misunderstood. That one must not be doubtful about the rhythm-determining syllables, that one should feel the breaking of the two rigid symmetry as intentional and as a charm, that one should lend a fine and patient ear to every staccato and every rubato, that one should divine the sense in the sequence of the vowels and diphthongs, and how delicately and richly they can be tinted and retinted in the order of their arrangement. Who among book-reading Germans is complacent enough to recognize such duties and requirements and to listen to so much art and intention in language? After all, one just has an ear for it, and so the most marked contrast of style are not heard, and the most delicate artistry as if it were squandered on the deaf. These were my thoughts when I noticed how clumsily and unintuitively two masters in the art of prose writing have been confounded. One, whose words drop down hesitatingly and coldly as from the roof of a damp cave. He counts on their dull sound and echo. And another, who manipulates his language like a flexible sword, and from his arm down into his toes feels the dangerous bliss of the quivering, over-sharp blade, which wishes to bite, hiss, and cut. How little the German style has to do with harmony and with the ear is shown by the fact that precisely our good musicians themselves write badly. The German does not read aloud. He does not read for the ear, but only with his eyes. He has put his ears away in the drawer for the time. In antiquity, when a man read, which was seldom enough, he read something to himself, and in a loud voice. They were surprised when anyone read silently, and thought secretly the reason of it. In a loud voice, that is to say, with all the swellings, inflections, and variations of key and changes of tempo, in which the ancient public world took delight. The laws of the written style were then the same as those of the spoken style, and these laws depended partly on the surprising development and refined requirements of the ear and larynx, partly on the strength, endurance, and power of the ancient lungs. In the ancient sense, a period is above all a physiological whole, inasmuch as it is comprised in one breath. Such periods, as occur in Demosthenes and Cicero, swelling twice and sinking twice, and all in one breath, were pleasures to the men of antiquity, who knew by their own schooling how to appreciate the virtue therein, the rareness and the difficulty in the deliverance of such a period. We have really no right to the big period, we modern men, who are short of breath in every sense. Those ancients, indeed, were all of them dilettanti in speaking, consequently connoisseurs, consequently critics. They thus brought their orators to the highest pitch, in the same manner as in the last century, when all Italian ladies and gentlemen knew how to sing, the virtuosoship of song, and with it also the art of melody, reached its elevation. In Germany, however, until quite recently, when a kind of platform eloquence began shyly and awkwardly enough to flutter its young wings, there was, properly speaking, only one kind of public and approximately artistical discourse, that delivered from the pulpit. The preacher was the only one in Germany who knew the weight of a syllable or a word, in which manner a sentence strikes, springs, rushes, flows, and comes to a close. He alone had a conscience in his ears, often enough a bad conscience, for reasons are not lacking why proficiency in oratory should be especially seldom attained by a German, or almost always too late. The masterpiece of German prose is therefore with good reason the masterpiece of its greatest preacher. The Bible has hitherto been the best German book. Compared with Luther's Bible, almost everything else is merely literature, something which has not grown in Germany and therefore has not taken and does not take root in German hearts as the Bible has done. There are two kinds of geniuses, one which above all engenders and seeks to engender, and another which willingly lets itself be fructified and brings forth. And similarly, among the gifted nations, there are those on whom the women's problem of pregnancy has devolved, and the secret task of forming, maturing, and perfecting. The Greeks, for instance, were a nation of this kind, and so are the French, and others which have to fructify to become the cause of new modes of life, like the Jews, the Romans, and, in all modesty, be it asked, like the Germans, nations tortured and enraptured by unknown fevers and irresistibly forced out of themselves, amorous and longing for foreign races, for such as let themselves be fructified, and withal imperious, like everything conscious of full being of generative force and consequently empowered by the grace of God. These two kinds of geniuses seek each other like man and woman, but they also misunderstand each other, like man and woman. Every nation has its own tartuffery and calls that its virtue. One does not know, cannot know, the best that is in one. What Europe owes to the Jews? Many things, good and bad, and above all one thing of the nature both of the best and the worst, the grand style in morality, the fearfulness and majesty of infinite demands, of infinite significations, the whole romanticism and sublimity of moral questionableness, and consequently just the most attractive and snaring and exquisite element in those iridescences and allurements to life, in the aftersheen of which the sky of our European culture, its evening sky, now glows, perhaps glows out. For this, we artists among the spectators and philosophers are grateful to the Jews. It must be taken into the bargain if various clouds and disturbances, in short, slight attacks of stupidity, pass over the spirit of a people that suffers and wants to suffer from national nervous fever and political ambition. For instance, among present-day Germans, there is alternately the anti-French folly, the anti-Semitic folly, the anti-Polish folly, the Christian romantic folly, the Wagnerian folly, the Teutonic folly, the Prussian folly. Just look at those poor historians, the Seibels and Treitschkes, and their closely bandaged heads. And whatever else these little obscurations of the German spirit and conscience may be called. May it be forgiven me that I, too, when on a short, daring sojourn on very infected ground, did not remain wholly exempt from the disease, but like everyone else, began to entertain thoughts about matters which did not concern me, the first symptom of political infection. About the Jews, for instance, listen to the following. I have never yet met a German who was favorably inclined to the Jews, and however decided the repudiation of actual anti-Semitism may be on the part of all prudent and political men, this prudence and policy is not perhaps directed against the nature of the sentiment itself, but only against its dangerous excess, and especially against the distasteful and infamous expression of this excess of sentiment. On this point, we must not deceive ourselves. That Germany has amply sufficient Jews, that the German stomach, the German blood, has difficulty and will long have difficulty in disposing only of this quality of Jew, as the Italian, the Frenchman, and the Englishman have done by means of a stronger digestion. That is the unmistakable declaration and language of a general instinct to which one must listen and according to which one must act. Let no more Jews come in and shut the doors, especially towards the east, also towards Austria. Thus commands the instinct of a people whose nature is still feeble and uncertain, so that it could be easily wiped out, easily extinguished by a stronger race. The Jews, however, are beyond all doubt the strongest, toughest, and purest race at present living in Europe. They know how to succeed even under the worst conditions, in fact, better than under favorable ones, by means of virtues of some sort which one would like nowadays to label as vices, owing, above all, to a resolute faith which does not need to be ashamed before modern ideas. They alter only, when they do alter, in the same way that the Russian Empire makes its conquest, as an empire that has plenty of time and is not of yesterday, namely, according to the principle, as slowly as possible. A thinker who has the future of Europe at heart will, in all his perspectives concerning the future, calculate upon the Jews, as he will calculate upon the Russians, as above all the surest and likeliest factors in the great play and battle of forces. That which is at present called a nation in Europe, and is rather something made, something born, indeed something confusingly similar to a something fictitious and unreal, is in every case something evolving, young, easily displaced, and not yet a race, much less such a race more enduring than bronze, as the Jews are such nations, should most carefully avoid all hot-headed rivalry and hostility. It is certain that the Jews, if they desired, or if they were driven to it, as the anti-Semites seem to wish, could now have the ascendancy, nay, literally the supremacy, over Europe. That they are not working and planning for that end is equally certain. Meanwhile, they rather wish and desire, even somewhat importunely, to be insorbed and absorbed by Europe. They long to be finally settled, authorized and respected somewhere, and wish to put an end to the nomadic life, to the wandering Jew. And one should certainly take account of this impulse and tendency and make advances to it. It possibly betokens a mitigation of the Jewish instincts, for which purpose it would perhaps be useful and fair to banish the anti-Semitic bawlers out of the country. One should make advances with all prudence and with selection, pretty much as the English nobility do. It stands to reason that the more powerful and strongly marked types of the new Germanism could enter into relation with the Jews with the least hesitation. For instance, the nobleman officer from the Prussian border, it would be interesting in many ways to see whether the genius for money and patience, and especially some intellect and intellectuality, sadly lacking in the place referred to, could not in addition be annexed and trained to the hereditary art of commanding and obeying, for both of which the country in question has now a classic reputation. But here it is expedient to break off my festal discourse and my sprightly Teutonomania, for I have already reached my serious topic, the European problem as I understand it, the rearing of a new ruling caste for Europe. They are not a philosophical race, the English. Bacon represents an attack on the philosophical spirit generally, Hobbes, Hume, and Locke an abasement and a deprecation of the idea of a philosopher for more than a century. It was against Hume that Kant uprose and raised himself. It was Locke of whom Schelling rightly said, "I despise Locke." In the struggle against the English mechanical stultification of the world, Hegel and Schopenhauer, along with Goethe, were of one accord. The two hostile brother geniuses in philosophy who pushed in different directions towards the opposite poles of German thought and thereby wronged each other as only brothers will do. What is lacking in England, and has always been lacking, that half-actor and rhetorician knew well enough, the absurd muddlehead Carlyle, who sought to conceal under passionate grimaces what he knew about himself, namely, what was lacking in Carlyle, real power of intellect, real depth of intellectual perception, in short, philosophy. It is characteristic of such an unphilosophical race to hold on firmly to Christianity. They need its discipline for moralizing and humanizing. The Englishman, more gloomy, sensual, headstrong, and brutal than the German, is for that very reason as the baser of the two, also the most pious. He has all the more need of Christianity. To finer nostrils, this English Christianity itself has still a characteristic English taint of spleen and alcoholic excess, for which, owing to good reasons, it is used as an antidote, the finer poison to neutralize the coarser. A finer form of poisoning is, in fact, a step in advance with coarse-mannered people, a step towards spiritualization. The English coarseness and rustic demureness is still more satisfactorily disguised by Christian pantomime and by praying and psalm singing, or more correctly, it is thereby explained and differently expressed. And for the herd of drunkards and rakes who formerly learned moral grunting under the influence of Methodism and more recently as the Salvation Army, a penitential fit may really be the relatively highest manifestation of humanity to which they can be elevated. So much may reasonably be admitted. That, however, which offends even in the humanist Englishman is his lack of music. To speak figuratively and also literally, he has neither rhythm nor dance in his movements of his soul and body. Indeed, not even the desire for rhythm and dance, for music. Listen to him speaking. Look at the most beautiful Englishwoman walking. In no country on earth are there more beautiful doves and swans. Finally, listen to them singing. But I ask too much. There are truths which are best recognized by mediocre minds because they are best adapted for them. There are truths which only possess charms and seductive power for mediocre spirits. One is pushed to this probably unpleasant conclusion now that the influence of respectable but mediocre Englishmen, I may mention Darwin, John Stuart Mill, and Herbert Spencer, begins to gain the ascendancy in the middle-class region of European taste. Indeed, who could doubt that it is a useful thing for such minds to have the ascendancy for a time? It would be an error to consider the highly developed and independently soaring minds as specially qualified for determining and collecting many little common facts and deducing conclusions from them. As exceptions, they are rather from the first in no very favorable position towards those who are the rules. After all, they have more to do than merely to perceive. In effect, they have to be something new. They have to signify something new. They have to represent new values. The gulf between knowledge and capacity is perhaps greater and also more mysterious than one thinks. The capable man in the grand style, the creator, will possibly have to be an ignorant person, while, on the other hand, for scientific discoveries like those of Darwin, a certain narrowness, aridity, and industrious carefulness, in short, something English, may not be unfavorable for arriving at them. Finally, let it not be forgotten that the English, with their profound mediocrity, brought about once before a general depression of European intelligence. What is called modern ideas, or the ideas of the 18th century, or French ideas, that consequently against which the German mind rose up with profound disgust, is of English origin. There is no doubt about it. The French were only the apes and actors of these ideas, their best soldiers, and likewise, alas, their first and profoundest victims. For owing to the diabolical Anglomania of modern ideas, the French soul has, in the end, become so thin and emaciated that at present one recalls its 16th and 17th centuries, its profound, passionate strength, its inventive excellency, almost with disbelief. One must, however, maintain this verdict of historical justice in a determined manner and defend it against present prejudices and appearances. The European nobility of sentiment, taste, and manners, taking the word in every high sense, is the work and invention of France. The European ignobleness, the plebeianism of modern ideas, is England's work and invention. Even at present, France is still the seat of the most intellectual and refined culture of Europe. It is still the high school of taste. But one must know how to find this France of taste. He who belongs to it keeps himself well concealed. They may be a small number in whom it lives and is embodied, besides perhaps being men who do not stand upon the strongest legs, in part fatalists, hypochondriacs, invalids, in part persons overindulged, overrefined, such as have the ambition to conceal themselves. They have all something in common. They keep their ears closed in presence of the delirious folly and noisy spouting of the democratic bourgeois. In fact, a besotted and brutalized France at present sprawls in the foreground. It recently celebrated a veritable orgy of bad taste and, at the same time, of self-admiration at the funeral of Victor Hugo. There is also something else common to them, a predilection to resist intellectual Germanizing, and a still greater inability to do so. In this France of intellect, which is also a France of pessimism, Schopenhauer has perhaps become more at home, and more indigenous than he has ever been in Germany. Not to speak of Heinrich Heine, who has long ago been reincarnated in the more refined and fastidious lyrists of Paris. Or of Hegel, who at present, in the form of Taine, the first of living historians, exercises an almost tyrannical influence. As regards Richard Wagner, however, the more French music learns to adapt itself to the actual needs of the modern soul, the more it will Wagnerite. One can safely predict that beforehand. It is already taking place sufficiently. There are, however, three things which the French can still boast of with pride as their heritage and possession, and as indelible tokens of their ancient intellectual superiority in Europe, in spite of all voluntary or involuntary Germanizing and vulgarizing of taste. Firstly, the capacity for artistic emotion, for devotion to form, for which the expression art for art's sake, along with numerous others, has been invented. Such capacity has not been lacking in France for three centuries, and owing to its reverence for the small number, it has again and again made a sort of chamber music of literature possible, which is sought for in vain elsewhere in Europe. The second thing whereby the French can lay claim to a superiority over Europe is their ancient, many-sided, moralistic culture, owing to which one finds, on an average, even in the petty novelist of the newspapers and chance Parisian men about town, a psychological sensitiveness and curiosity, of which, for example, one has no conception, to say nothing of the thing itself, in Germany. The Germans lack a couple of centuries of the moralistic work requisite thereto, which, as we have said, France has not grudged. Those who call the Germans naive on that account give them commendation for a defect, as the opposite of the German inexperience and innocence in the delight of psychology, which is not too remotely associated with the tediousness of German intercourse, and as the most successful expression of genuine French curiosity and inventive talent in this domain of delicate thrills. Henri Bayl may be noted, that remarkable anticipatory and forerunning man, who, with a Napoleonic tempo, traversed his Europe, in fact, several centuries of the European soul as a surveyor and discoverer thereof. It has required two generations to overtake him one way or other, to divine long afterwards some of the riddles that perplexed and enraptured him. This strange Epicurean and man of interrogation, the last great psychologist of France. There is yet a third claim to superiority. In the French character, there is a successful halfway synthesis of the North and South, which makes them comprehend many things and enjoins upon them other things which an Englishman can never comprehend. Their temperament, turned alternately to and from the South, in which, from time to time, the Provençal and Ligurian blood froths over, preserves them from the dreadful northern gray in gray, from sunless conceptual specterism, and from poverty of blood, our German infirmity of taste, for the excess excessive prevalence of which, at the present moment, blood and iron, that is to say, high politics, has with great resolution been prescribed, according to a dangerous healing art, which bids me wait and wait, but not yet hope. There is also still in France a pre-understanding and ready welcome for those rarer and rarely gifted men who are too comprehensive to find satisfaction in any kind of fatherlandism and know how to love the South when in the North and the North when in the South. The born Midlanders, the good Europeans. For them, Bizet has made music, this latest genius, who has seen a new beauty and seduction, who has discovered a piece of the South in music. I hold that many precautions should be taken against German music. Suppose a person loves the South as I love it, as a great school of recovery for the most spiritual and the most sensuous ills, as a boundless solar profusion and effulgence which overspreads a sovereign existence believing in itself. Well, such a person will learn to be somewhat on his guard against German music, because in injuring his taste anew, it will also injure his health anew. Such a southerner not by origin but by belief, if he should dream of the future of music, must also dream of it being freed from the influence of the North, and must have in his ears the prelude to a deeper, mightier, and perhaps more perverse and mysterious music, a super German music, which does not fade, pale and die away as all German music does at the sight of the blue wanton sea and the Mediterranean clearness of sky. A super European music which holds its own even in the presence of the brown sunsets of the desert, whose soul is akin to the palm tree and can be at home and can roam with big, beautiful, lonely beasts of prey. I could imagine a music of which the rarest charm would be that it knew nothing more of good and evil, only that here and there perhaps some sailor's homesickness, some golden shadows and tender weaknesses might sweep lightly over it, an art which, from the far distance, would see the colors of a sinking and almost incomprehensible moral world fleeing towards it, and would be hospitable enough and profound enough to receive such belated fugitives. Owing to the morbid estrangement which the nationality craze has induced and still induces among the nations of Europe, owing also to the short-sighted and hasty-handed politicians who, with the help of this craze, are at present in power and do not suspect to what extent the disintegrating policy they pursue must necessarily be only an interlude policy, owing to all this and much else that is altogether unmentionable at present, the most unmistakable signs that Europe wishes to be one are now overlooked or arbitrarily and falsely misinterpreted. With all the more profound and large-minded men of this century, the real general tendency of the mysterious labor of their souls was to prepare the way for that new synthesis and tentatively to anticipate the European of the future. Only in their simulations, or in their weaker moments, in old age perhaps, did they belong to the fatherlands. They only wrested from themselves when they became patriots. I think of such men as Napoleon, Goethe, Beethoven, Stendhal, Heinrich Heine, Schopenhauer. It must not be taken amiss if I also count Richard Wagner among them, about whom one must not let oneself be deceived by his own misunderstandings. Geniuses like him have seldom the right to understand themselves. Still less, of course, by the unseemly noise with which he is now resisted and opposed in France. The fact remains, nevertheless, that Richard Wagner and the later French Romanticism of the 40s are most closely and intimately related to one another. They are akin, fundamentally akin, in all the heights and depths of their requirements. It is Europe, the one Europe, whose soul presses urgently and longingly outwards and upwards in their multifarious and boisterous art. Whither? Into a new light? Towards a new sun? But who would attempt to express accurately what all these masters of new modes of speech could not express distinctly? It is certain that the same storm and stress tormented them, that they sought in the same manner these last great seekers, all of them steeped in literature to their eyes and ears, the first artists of universal literary culture, for the most part even themselves writers, poets, intermediaries, and blenders of the arts and the senses. Wagner, as musician, is reckoned among painters, as poet among musicians, as artist generally among actors. All of them fanatics for expression at any cost. I specially mention Delacroix, the nearest related to Wagner. All of them great discoverers in the realm of the sublime, also of the loathsome and dreadful, still greater discoverers in effect, in display, in the art of the show shop. All of them talented far beyond their genius, out and out virtuosi, with mysterious accesses to all that seduces, allures, constrains, and upsets, born enemies of logic and of the straight line, hankering after the strange, the exotic, the monstrous, the crooked, and the self-contradictory. As men, Tantaluses of the will, plebeian parvenus, who knew themselves to be incapable of a noble tempo, or of a lento in life and action. Think of Balzac, for instance. Unrestrained workers, almost destroying themselves by work. Antinomians and rebels in manners, ambitious and insatiable, without equilibrium and enjoyment. All of them finally shattering and sinking down at the Christian cross, and with right and reason. For who of them would have been sufficiently profound and sufficiently original for an anti-Christian philosophy? On the whole, a bold, daring, splendidly overbearing, high-flying, and aloft up-dragging class of higher men, who had first to teach their century, and it is the century of the masses, the conception higher man. Let the German friends of Richard Wagner advise together as to whether there is anything purely German in the Wagnerian art, or whether its distinction does not consist precisely in coming from super German sources and impulses, in which connection it may not be underrated how indispensable Paris was to the development of his type, which the strength of his instincts made him long to visit at the most decisive time, and how the whole of his proceedings of his self-apostolate could only perfect itself in sight of the French socialistic original. On a more subtle comparison, it will perhaps be found, to the honor of Richard Wagner's German nature, that he has acted in everything with more strength, daring, severity, and elevation than a 19th century Frenchman could have done, owing to the circumstance that we Germans are as yet nearer to barbarism than the French. Perhaps even the most remarkable creation of Richard Wagner is not only at present, but forever inaccessible, incomprehensible, and inimitable to the whole latter-day Latin race. The figure of Siegfried, that very free man, who is probably far too free, too hard, too cheerful, too healthy, too anti-Catholic for the taste of old and mellow civilized nations. He may even have been a sin against Romanticism, this anti-Latin Siegfried. Well, Wagner atoned amply for this sin in his old sad days, when, anticipating a taste which has meanwhile passed into politics, he began with the religious vehemence peculiar to him to preach, at least, the way to Rome, if not to walk therein. That these last words may not be understood, I will call to my aid a few powerful rhymes, which will even betray to less delicate ears what I mean counter to the last Wagner and his Parsifal music. Is this our mode? From German heart came this vexed ululating? From German body this self-lacerating? Is ours this priestly hand dilation, this incense-fuming exaltation? Is ours this faltering, falling, shambling, this quite uncertain ding-dong dangling, this sly nun ogling, ave hour bell ringing, this holy false enraptured heaven o'erspringing? Is this our mode? Think well, ye still wait for admission, for what ye hear is Rome, Rome's faith, by intuition. Chapter 9. What is noble? Every elevation of the type man has hitherto been the work of an aristocratic society, and so it will always be, a society believing in a long scale of gradations of rank and differences of worth among human beings, and requiring slavery in some form or other. Without the pathos of distance, such as grows out of the incarnated difference of classes, out of the constant outlooking and downlooking of the ruling caste on subordinates and instruments, and out of their equally constant practice of obeying and commanding, of keeping down and keeping at a distance, that other more mysterious pathos could never have arisen, the longing for an ever new widening of distance within the soul itself, the formation of ever higher, rarer, further, more extended, more comprehensive states, in short, just the elevation of the type man, the continued self-surmounting of man, to use a moral formula in a supermoral sense. To be sure, one must not resign oneself to any humanitarian illusions about the history of the origin of an aristocratic society, that is to say, of the preliminary condition for the elevation of the type man. The truth is hard. Let us acknowledge unprejudicedly how every higher civilization hitherto has originated. Men with a still natural nature, barbarians in every terrible sense of the word, men of prey, still in possession of unbroken strength of will and desire for power, threw themselves upon weaker, more moral, more peaceful races, perhaps trading or cattle-rearing communities, or upon old, mellow civilizations in which the final, vital force was flickering out in brilliant fireworks of wit and depravity. At the commencement, the noble caste was always the barbaric caste. Their superiority did not consist first of all in their physical, but in their psychical power. They were more complete men, which at every point also implies the same as more complete beasts. Corruption, as the indication that anarchy threatens to break out among the instincts and that the foundation of the emotions, called life, is convulsed, is something radically different according to the organization in which it manifests itself. When, for instance, an aristocracy like that of France at the beginning of the Revolution flung away its privileges with sublime disgust and sacrificed itself to an excess of its moral sentiments, it was corruption. It was really only the closing act of the corruption which had existed for centuries, by virtue of which that aristocracy had abdicated step by step its lordly prerogatives and lowered itself to a function of royalty, in the end, even to its decoration and parade dress. The essential thing, however, in a good and healthy aristocracy is that it should not regard itself as a function either of the kingship or of the commonwealth, but as the significance and higher justification thereof, that it should therefore accept with a good conscience the sacrifice of a legion of individuals who, for its sake, must be suppressed and reduced to imperfect men, to slaves and instruments. Its fundamental belief must be precisely that society is not allowed to exist for its own sake, but only as a foundation and scaffolding, by means of which a select class of beings may be able to elevate themselves to their higher duties, and in general, to a higher existence. Like those sun-seeking climbing plants in Java, they are called Cipo Matador, which encircle an oak so long and so often with their arms, until at last, high above it, but supported by it, they can unfold their tops in the open light and exhibit their happiness. To refrain mutually from injury, from violence, from exploitation, and put one's will on a par with that of others, this may result in a certain rough sense in good conduct among individuals when the necessary conditions are given, namely, the actual similarity of the individuals in amount of force and degree of worth, and their correlation within one organization. As soon, however, as one wished to take this principle more generally, and if possible, even as the fundamental principle of society, it would immediately disclose what it really is, namely, a will to the denial of life, a principle of dissolution and decay. Here, one must think profoundly to the very basis and resist all sentimental weakness. Life itself is essentially appropriation, injury, conquest of the strange and weak, suppression, severity, obtrusion of peculiar forms, incorporation, and at the least, putting it mildest, exploitation. But why should one forever use precisely these words on which for ages a disparaging purpose has been stamped? Even the organization within which, as was previously supposed, the individuals treat each other as equal, it takes place in every healthy aristocracy, must itself, if it be a living and not a dying organization, do all that towards other bodies, which the individuals within it refrain from doing to each other. It will have to be the incarnated will to power. It will endeavor to grow, to gain ground, attract itself, and acquire ascendancy. Not owing to any morality or immorality, but because it lives, and because life is precisely will to power. On no point, however, is the ordinary consciousness of Europeans more unwilling to be corrected than on this matter. People now rave everywhere, even under the guise of science, about coming conditions of society in which the exploiting character is to be absent. That sounds to my ears as if they promised to invent a mode of life which should refrain from all organic functions. Exploitation does not belong to a depraved or imperfect and primitive society. It belongs to the nature of the living being as a primary organic function. It is a consequence of the intrinsic will to power, which is precisely the will to life. Granting that as a theory this is a novelty, as a reality it is the fundamental fact of all history, let us be so far honest towards ourselves. In a tour through the many finer and coarser moralities which have hitherto prevailed or still prevailed on the earth, I found certain traits recurring regularly together and connected with one another until finally two primary types revealed themselves to me and a radical distinction was brought to light. There is master morality and slave morality. I would at once add, however, that in all higher and mixed civilizations, there are also attempts at the reconciliation of the two moralities. But one finds still oftener the confusion and mutual misunderstanding of them. Indeed, sometimes their close juxtaposition, even in the same man, within one soul. The distinctions of moral values have either originated in a ruling caste, pleasantly conscious of being different from the ruled, or among the ruled class, the slaves and dependents of all sorts. In the first case, when it is the rulers who determine the conception good, it is the exalted, proud disposition which is regarded as the distinguishing feature, and that which determines the order of rank. The noble type of man separates from himself the beings in whom the opposite of this exalted, proud disposition displays itself. He despises them. Let it at once be noted that in this first kind of morality, the antithesis good and bad means practically the same as noble and despicable. The antithesis good and evil is of a different origin. The cowardly, the timid, the insignificant, and those thinking merely of narrow utility are despised. Moreover, also, the distrustful, with their constrained glances, the self-abasing, the dog-like kind of men who let themselves be abused, the mendicant flatterers, and above all, the liars. It is a fundamental belief of all aristocrats that the common people are untruthful. We, truthful ones, the nobility in ancient Greece called themselves. It is obvious that everywhere the designations of moral value were at first applied to men and were only derivatively and at a later period applied to actions. It is a gross mistake, therefore, when historians of morals start with questions like, why have sympathetic actions been praised? The noble type of man regards himself as a determiner of values. He does not require to be approved of. He passes the judgment. What is injurious to me is injurious in itself. He knows that it is he himself only who confers honor on things. He is a creator of values. He honors whatever he recognizes in himself. Such morality equals self-glorification. In the foreground, there is the feeling of plenitude, of power, which seeks to overflow, the happiness of high tension, the consciousness of a wealth which would fain give and bestow. The noble man also helps the unfortunate, but not, or scarcely, out of pity, but rather from an impulse generated by the superabundance of power. The noble man honors in himself the powerful one, him also who has power over himself, who knows how to speak and how to keep silence, who takes pleasure in subjugating himself to severity and hardness, and has reverence for all that is severe and hard. Wotan placed a hard heart in my breast, says an old Scandinavian saga. It is thus rightly expressed from the soul of a proud Viking. Such a type of man is even proud of not being made for sympathy. The hero of the saga therefore adds warningly, "He who has not a hard heart when young will never have one." The noble and brave who think thus are the furthest removed from morality, which seeks precisely in sympathy or in acting for the good of others or in disinterestedness the characteristic of the moral. Faith in oneself, pride in oneself, a radical enmity and irony towards selflessness, belong as definitely to noble morality as do a careless scorn and precaution in presence of sympathy and the warm heart. It is the powerful who know how to honor. It is their art, their domain for invention. The profound reverence for age and for tradition. All law rests on this double reverence, the belief and prejudice in favor of ancestors and unfavorable to newcomers is typical in the morality of the powerful. And if, reversely, men of modern ideas believe almost instinctively in progress and the future and are more and more lacking in respect for old age, the ignoble origin of these ideas has complacently betrayed itself thereby. A morality of the ruling class, however, is more especially foreign and irritating to present-day taste in the sternness of its principle that one has duties only to one's equals, that one may act towards beings of a lower rank, towards all that is foreign just as seems good to one, or as the heart desires, and in any case, beyond good and evil. It is here that sympathy and similar sentiments can have a place. The ability and obligation to exercise prolonged gratitude and prolonged revenge, both only within the circle of equals, artfulness in retaliation, raffinement of the idea in friendship, a certain necessity to have enemies as outlets for the emotions of envy, quarrelsomeness, arrogance, in fact, in order to be a good friend, all these are typical characteristics of the noble morality, which, as has been pointed out, it is not the morality of moral ideas and is therefore at present difficult to realize and also to unearth and disclose. It is otherwise with the second type of morality, slave morality. Supposing that the abused, the oppressed, the suffering, the unemancipated, the weary, and those uncertain of themselves should moralize, what will be the common element in their moral estimates? Probably a pessimistic suspicion with regard to the entire situation of man will find expression, perhaps a condemnation of man together with his situation. The slave has an unfavorable eye for the virtues of the powerful. He has a skepticism and distrust, a refinement of distrust of everything good that there is honored. He would fain persuade himself that the very happiness there is not genuine. On the other hand, those qualities which serve to alleviate the existence of sufferers are brought into prominence and flooded with light. It is here that sympathy, the kind, helping hand, the warm heart, patience, diligence, humility, and friendliness attain to honor. For here, these are the most useful qualities, and almost the only means of supporting the burden of existence. Slave morality is essentially the morality of utility. Here is the seat of the origin of the famous antithesis good and evil. Power and dangerousness are assumed to reside in the evil, a certain dreadfulness, subtlety, and strength which do not admit of being despised. According to slave morality, therefore, the evil man arouses fear. According to master morality, it is precisely the good man who arouses fear and seeks to arouse it, while the bad man is regarded as the despicable being. The contrast attains its maximum when, in accordance with the logical consequences of slave morality, a shade of deprecation, it might be slight and well-intentioned, at last attaches itself to the good man of this morality. Because, according to the servile mode of thought, the good man must in any case be the safe man. He is good-natured, easily deceived, perhaps a little stupid. Everywhere that slave morality gains the ascendancy, language shows a tendency to approximate the significations of the words good and stupid. A last fundamental difference: the desire for freedom, the instinct for happiness, and the refinements of the feeling of liberty belong as necessarily to slave morals and morality, as artifice and enthusiasm in reverence and devotion are the regular symptoms of an aristocratic mode of thinking and estimating. Hence, we can understand without further detail why love, as a passion, it is our European specialty, must absolutely be of noble origin. As is well known, its invention is due to the Provençal poet cavaliers, those brilliant, ingenious men of the joyful science to whom Europe owes so much and almost owes itself. Vanity is one of the things which are perhaps most difficult for a noble man to understand. He will be tempted to deny it where another kind of man thinks he sees it self-evidently. The problem for him is to represent to his mind beings who seek to arouse a good opinion of themselves which they themselves do not possess, and consequently also do not deserve, and who yet believe in this good opinion afterwards. This seems to him, on the one hand, such bad taste and so self-disrespectful and, on the other hand, so grotesquely unreasonable that he would like to consider vanity an exception, and is doubtful about it in most cases when it is spoken of. He will say, for instance, "I may be mistaken about my value, and, on the other hand, may nevertheless demand that my value should be acknowledged by others precisely as I rate it." That, however, is not vanity, but self-conceit, or, in most cases,